This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The year 2012 started out strangely. In Rapid City, South Dakota, it was 73 degrees Fahrenheit, about 23 Celsius, in the first week of January. That was hotter than Miami, which only reached 69 degrees. It was 61 in Boston, for heaven's sakes. The first week of January was warmer in Calgary, Canada, than in Disneyland, California. In late December, Western Australia hit 49 degrees C. That's 120 degrees in the shade. Too hot to stand it. Is it global warming? Unlike the climate deniers who flourish in every cold spell and then go under a rock in the heat, I can't be sure this is climate change. Meteorologist Jeff Masters over at the Weather Underground attributes some of the weird weather to changes in something called the Arctic Oscillation. Find that link in my show blog at ecoshock.info. But I do know, these warm winters will become normal in 10 or 20 years if we go on polluting the atmosphere with greenhouse gases. Now we are going to talk about real climate. One of the joys of being a green host, I get to go deep with some of the world's best scientists. First, we're heading out on a journey through deep time, right up to the future, with Australia's Dr. Andrew Glickson. Then we have a brief chat with another scientist you should meet, Professor William Calvin from Washington State. I'm Alex Smith. Are you ready for Radio EcoShock? What will the future climate be like? Why do mass extinctions happen, and is one happening right now? To know what Earth is capable of, we must look into the deep past of our little planet. We're going on a voyage into the life of Earth through the eyes of one of Australia's most eminent scientists. Dr. Andrew Glickson reads rocks to find important stories that you were not taught in school, that we need to know. Andrew Glickson was the principal research scientist for the Australian Geological Survey Organization. Now he works with the Australian National University and the Planetary Science Institute. I am your host, Alex Smith. I've been receiving and studying Andrew Glickson papers for years. He's one of my mentors. So it is a pleasure to welcome you, Andrew, to this Radio EcoShock program.
Yes, well, thank you very much for having me on.
Andrew, we may be living in a pivotal time for our species and our planet, but I want to start with a small detail that our listeners will notice. You don't sound like a typical Australian. Why not?
Well, in a way I am, because since 1964 I have travelled right through the country and mapped its geology and known the outback quite well as any Australian. But you're correct. I have an accent. My father was from Germany, my mother from Latvia, and so the story goes on.
And do you go out pretty well every year? Do you spend a lot of time in the bush?
Until 4 years ago, I went every year virtually for several months. Since then, much of my work is now to do with climate and also exploration of subterranean structures buried deep in the earth, which means we use remote sensing, geophysical and geochemical methods.
So why is Australia good for hunting up the past?
Australia, or much of it, the center and the west, is a very stable continent, which means the formations, geological formations, have been preserved all the way back to about 3.6 billion years ago. And in some areas, they're very well preserved to the extent that we still have the original texture, the original chemistry and isotope composition of these materials, especially in Western Australia, which allows us to decipher the history of the Earth going back that far in time.
And why did you move beyond geology to develop your interest in past mass extinction events and the climate?
Yes, well, thanks for asking that. I have been studying the effect of asteroids and comets on mass extinctions in the past, and several major ones. The best-known one is the KT boundary, so-called 65 million years ago, with a major mass extinction of more than 60% of species and so on have been extinguished, largely due to climatic changes. First, emission of dust and aerosols have resulted in freezing conditions. Then the greenhouse gases emitted, released from the rocks, have resulted in longer-term greenhouse effect. And even before that, the flash from the asteroid incinerating large areas. I became very interested in the origin of mass extinctions, and it didn't take long to look around and realize that we are living through one in terms of particularly changes in the atmosphere ocean system.
Before we get to the present and the future, I'd like to go back to the very beginning of life on Earth. Do we know when that started, and what was the planet like back then?
We don't have a date. The oldest fossils as such are 3.5 billion years old. There are older rocks, and there are some signs of organic biological material in rocks which are 3.8 billion years old in Greenland and so on, but they're rather uncertain. Now, even before that, the Earth had a crust and had volcanic activity, but we only have minerals, relic minerals from 4.4 billion years ago. We have zircons and zirconium silicate. We don't know that there was life then, but from the extremes to which microbes can adapt to in terms of temperature and pressure and so on, it's very likely that some microbial life has existed not long after the Earth has accreted, perhaps around 4.4, 4.5, but we don't really know.
And I was surprised to learn from your papers that Earth was much hotter than today for a very long time, perhaps longer than we've ever seen ice. So can you tell us what the Earth and the oceans were like in the early first billion or 2 years of our times?
Yes, well, of course, a lot is unknown. I mean, we have only a few pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. So whatever I say is subject to major questions, but to the extent that we know, well, the geothermal heat flow was certainly higher at that stage. Very thin crust and very active mantle and mantle plumes and so on. But from point of view of the atmosphere, the sun was much weaker, perhaps 25-30% weaker than it is now. So in that respect, the atmosphere and the surface did not receive the radiation it does now. On the other hand, the level of greenhouse gases, which is carbon dioxide and methane, were much higher then because there was no way for them to be absorbed by the crust and by the water. The water being warm, they don't take much carbon dioxide. There were possibly not very high mountain ranges to sequester the carbon dioxide. So even though the Earth was warmer and there were a lot of greenhouse gases, the lower effect of the sun meant that we had oceans. And the fact that we had oceans means, well, certainly temperatures were well below boiling point.
And then at one point in the last billion years, Earth did get a lot colder. Tell us about Snowball Earth and what happened to living things then.
Yes, the living things at Snowball Earth, which is about 700 million years ago, so they were still very primitive, mostly bacteria and bacterial colonies, that's stromatolites. Well, how did Snowball Earth form? That is subject to a number of theories, but we know that, that what happened is, well, the sun was still very weak, for one thing. The levels of carbon dioxide, quite surprisingly, were not very low, but then the sun was weaker. I don't know that anyone has the final answer for the origin of Snowball Earth, and there were glaciations before then. There were glaciations at about 2,400 million years ago and so on. So I'm afraid I have to say that we don't have the final answer, although there are a number of theories.
But the whole of the seas did not freeze or anything that extreme. How far did it go, do we think?
I think that much of the Earth is frozen. I think still some ocean has remained. The thing is, this was a critical point in the evolution of life because following the Snowball Earth, the level of oxygen has risen in the atmosphere and in the oceans, and that's what allowed proteins to form, which was the basis of the more advanced animals, which is leading us to about 540 million years ago, called the Cambrian explosion. It's when proliferation of animals, multicellular protein structured animals, has appeared. Lots of fossils of them in several areas.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with the Australian earth scientist, Dr. Andrew Glickson. And we started talking about mass extinctions, and in earlier years, people blamed asteroids or volcanoes. You have mapped out such events in time. Are these the causes of previous mass die-offs on Earth?
Well, I think we have a fair idea now, because there's a lot of evidence. Earlier, paleontologists thought that species just reach a stage at which they somehow degenerate and die. But this is not the view of quite a number of other Earth scientists, so it's not my view, because in just about every case in which we had a major extinction of species, we have an internal or external forcing, what we call. The internal ones being volcanic activities, they would have been of very large scale and would have polluted the atmosphere with both aerosols, that's sulfur dioxide, which causes freezing of large areas. We call it volcanic winter. They are external forces, were asteroids and comets. And a number of them is now recorded. The signatures of such impacts are recorded confidently in at least three cases, and less directly, conclusively, in a number of other ones. The asteroid impact causes quite a number of things. First, the flash, where it enters the atmosphere of a large region, it just incinerates, causes regional fires. The second one, the seismic effect, which will just about dislodge anything around, including, well, at that stage, including mostly trees, but it would have an effect. Then the aerosols, which is dust and anything vaporized from the rocks, which means carbon dioxide, methane, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, and so on, would form a concoction in the atmosphere that would first result in a, we call it asteroid winter, at short term, maybe a few years, maybe a few decades, and then a large amount of carbon dioxide should result in global warming. We have very good evidence for it now.
Are we saying, though, that these past mass extinctions required something from outer space to hit, or is it possible that the Earth itself can generate enough forces that would cause a mass extinction?
Oh, yes, the Earth itself, very, very likely, and like through volcanic events, which I mentioned before. There is a possibility that some of this volcanic effect was triggered by very large asteroid impacts. They occur in clusters. They normally occur in more than one at a time, fragments of larger bodies. So it's a combination. And in some cases, it's just the asteroid. In some cases, it's just volcanic. In other cases, it's volcanism triggered by impacts.
Well, returning to the timeline of Earth, when did today's Antarctic ice sheet begin to form, and why did that happen? Do we know?
That's actually been studied in quite a lot of detail. 35 million years ago, there was a cluster of asteroids, three of them. We found one under the Timor Sea. Very large asteroids. There's one of Virginia, United States, Chesapeake Bay. One in Siberia called Popeye. One under the Timor Sea. That's this for 35 million. We're not quite sure whether there is a connection between that and between what happened next, because 34 million years ago, the Antarctic split from South America through the Drake Passage. This allowed the formation of the circumantarctic cold current, circumpolar current, which isolated Antarctic from warmer influences of lower latitudes. In this connection, temperature drop occurred very, very fast, about 5 degrees mean global temperature drop. This is enormous. And the Antarctic formed, and formed since then, the Antarctic in the circumantarctic polar currents and the Antarctic wind vortex formed like the refrigerator of the Earth, the thermostat of the Earth, if you like, from which cold winds and cold currents have emanated, cooling up the lower latitudes and even the tropics.
Indeed, Andrew Glickson, you have written that these polar ice caps may be necessary for the survival of mammals, including humans. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, when mammals, during the warm periods of the Earth, the so-called greenhouse phases, which is mostly the Cretaceous, which is about between 140 million and 65 million, Mammoths existed, but they lived as small burrowing animals underground, escaping from both the heat, because they had a different blood temperature system, and from the dinosaurs. Until sometime in the mid-Eocene, we're talking here about perhaps 40 million years ago, or 45, when conditions on Earth started to cool significantly, and the dinosaurs were gone, thanks to the large Katy boundary asteroid impact. Mammals started to appear then on the continents, and they grew very large. And the cooler the conditions, like following this strong drop in temperature at the late Eocene, 34 million years ago, the mammals have grown even larger and existed until the extinction of the megafauna, which is about approximately 10,000 years ago and attributed largely to the effect of humans.
Such as the great woolly mammoth, for example?
Yes, it's one of them.
And the saber-toothed tiger. Well, in the past million years, though, as the human species evolved, there have been serious changes in climate. Giant ice sheets buried the continents at times and then retreated. Does this tell us humans are adapted to survive climate change?
Well, we are creatures of the ice age. Humans have appeared about 3 or 4 million years ago when, further, once again, the Earth was cooling to a further extent. That's when the rainforest started to recede. The savanna, the bush, has been expanding. The grasses have emerged. And the bipeds, the humans, and the primates started to come down from the rainforest, from the trees, and populate the savanna. We are very much creatures of not just the Ice Age, but it's actually the Super Ice Age, when temperatures plunged further, perhaps 2 degrees, since about 3 million years ago, and the Ice Age have onset. It's very interesting why the Ice Age set on from that time. It appears that the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was so low, oscillating between 180 and 280, that the effects of the Milankovitch cycle of the sun, the solar forcing, have been enhanced. Because otherwise, in previous period, carbon dioxide greenhouse gases have been buffering the Earth's surface, keeping it warm, or buffering it from the to a large extent, from the effect of the sun.
Well, going back into human evolution, your paper, A Fire Species, suggests humans were changing the Earth and the atmosphere from our earliest days of capturing fire. How important was that change?
Well, this is more than important. That's the first time ever in the history of the planet that an organism, biological entity, have mastered fire. No other species does it. And by mastering fire, humans increase the energy output, and thereby the entropy in nature, that's the potential energy entropy, increase the dissociation of entropy, of potential energy, by many orders of magnitude. What it means, if I can bring an example, we, as I sit here talking, I use maybe 2 calories per minute. Now, through a power generator, well, we use hundreds of thousands and millions of calories, depending on the size of the plant. That's all energy that's dissipated, and that's affecting nature.
So we've magnified our use of fire just time and time again and until we reach the coal plant, for example.
We have magnified the use of fire as far as the biosphere is concerned, like the plants and the trees, which have been burned by prehistoric humans. But once we arrived at the stage of discovering combustion, 16th, 17th century, we have now starting to burn the remnants of previous biospheres. Biospheres, plant material disintegrated, transformed to carbon, and to oil, coal and oil and gas, which formed over several hundred million years of Earth's history. So we are decarbonizing the rocks, the crust, and transferring this coal to the atmosphere. An atmosphere which is about 10 kilometers thick, breathable atmosphere. It's very much like the lungs, our lungs, which exchange the carbon and oxygen cycle, which allows life. It's the carbon and oxygen cycles which allow the biosphere to exist, plus, of course, the effect of solar radiation and the presence of water. We are decarbonizing large parts of the sediments, of the previous biosphere, and we're transferring it, holus bolus, to the atmosphere. The scale of it, I think, is geological, and even today has not been perhaps fully appreciated by people.
Before we continue with the present and maybe estimate our future chances, I want to mention you also propose a theory about the role of fire in our psychology and society. Would you tell us about that?
Yes, this cannot be proven. There are many lines of evidence which render it likely, but because the relics are far and few between, it's not as perhaps confident as some of the geological observations that we have been talking about. However, burial has appeared after, that's human burial, appeared after fire was mastered. Now, part of the theory is subjective. I mean, many of us sit around campfires, and I've done it for 40 years, so we have an idea of what it's like to sit around the fire and what effect it has on the mind. But this prehistoric humans, they were sitting around campfire, which were their home, for hundreds of thousands of years. And when you combine the effect of fire, which we know directly, personally, with a time factor of hundreds of thousands of years, when fire was actually, in many instances, the human habitat around which humans sat at night. And there is a lot of evidence for it in mythologies, ancient prehistoric and historic human mythologies of fire, Prometheus, of course, but many other Indian. Then the idea develops, which to me sounds very likely, but again is hard to prove because the material relics of this development are very hard to find. That fire had an effect on the human mind, which created imagination, enhanced fear, and that this fear has then been magnified. And when humans developed agriculture, sustainable agriculture, but 8,000 years ago, they were able to express this imagination, express this fear, express their ideas of the gods in many ways, like building pyramids, going on big wars, and so on.
Well, we talk about how television or the iPhone affects our minds. It sounds reasonable that, as you say, 100,000 years or more of sitting around a campfire may also have been part of our social and mental evolution at the very least. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and we're talking with one of the experts in both Earth's history and our developing climate crisis. He is Dr. Andrew Glickson from Australia. Andrew, how fragile is our current climate situation?
It's very serious. It's so serious that I even find it hard to talk about it. It's like a pathologist looking at the blood count, white and red cells, of a seriously ill patient and being reluctant to talk too much about it with the patient for obvious reasons.
Why is this climate change more threatening than the previous shifts that you've studied in Earth's past?
But there were no humans then. They were very serious. The dinosaur extinction, in a way, is a climate change because the atmosphere has been shot, so to speak, first with aerosols, then with greenhouse gases. Very serious for the dinosaurs. I'm sorry for the comparison. There have been extreme climate changes in the past, but civilization was not there. There were also extreme ones when prehistoric humans lived. These people, in fact, were affected, but they had the potential of migrating to the relatively more sheltered areas, such as the rift valleys in Africa, where lakes and more water, escaping from whatever happened. The sea levels went up and down, temperatures went up and down, the ice sheets have extended and receded, but humans have migrated with the fauna. They migrated with the herds of deer and elephants and other that they actually hunted.
Well, and there were so few humans then. I've just read geneticists are thinking that it's possible at one point we came down to as few as 10 or 20,000 humans in some bottleneck. You know, there was lots of room for people to expand and live, which we don't have now. Everywhere's occupied. If a delta floods, where are a million people going to go?
Well, that's exactly right. Going back to prehistoric time just for a moment, when Mount Toba in Sumatra erupted, the extent to which the global dimming due to the sulfur aerosols has reached has resulted in a decimation of human populations. And it was during the ice age, during the glacial period, but it's brought temperatures even further down. So this was close to extinction, and only relatively few humans have been left. But now you're talking about the present now, right?
Yes.
Well, our civilization is anchored to a large extent in river valleys, river deltas, coastal plains, coastal cities. Our civilization is anchored on the seashores to a large extent, not entirely, which means sea levels rise. Well, that's quite something, isn't it?
Indeed. Well, you know, one of the people speaking out very strongly on our situation is Dr. James Hansen of NASA. He's one of many scientists warning the climate is more sensitive to even small changes, like 1 degree in global mean temperature, than we realized even 20 years ago. And he's pointed to the warming in the pipeline that I think you mentioned that's hidden by our pollution. Do you think Dr. Hansen is being too extreme, or what do you appreciate about his message, if you do?
Yeah, I have read most of James Hansen's papers, which are some of the most detailed and scholarly and well-founded, consistent with the evidence, consistent with the laws of physics and chemistry. I've read many of them, and I'm afraid that I think he is correct. I also collaborated with him to some extent a few years ago through correspondence and a petition to the Australian government.
What were you asking the Australian government to do?
Well, at the time, this was Kevin Rudd's government, and James Hansen wrote a letter to the Prime Minister. We collaborated in that connection. Nothing much ensued.
As too often happens. As you know, just recently, Russian and American scientists have discovered fountains of methane rising up out of the shallow East Siberian seas, now exposed to more sunlight after the retreat of summer ice. Why are so many scientists worried about that news?
Well, methane can be expected to be released from permafrost and from shallow lakes and shallow seabed, where it's tight connected with icicles and so on that acclimatize. It can be expected to be released, but the question is, what's the scale of this release? Methane has, when it's released, when it's fresh, some 70 times the radiative forcing than carbon dioxide. It eventually disintegrates into carbon dioxide, but it takes a number of years. And when it disintegrates, it becomes 20 times as powerful. So methane is it's a powerful greenhouse gas. The same is true for nitrous oxide, which is released from fertilizers and forms through fires and so on. Why is it so worrying? Well, it's been in a way predicted that this might happen, depending on the warming. But the warming in the polar region is between 2 and 4 times as high as on the continents. And that's not normally appreciated by people. People think we're only at 0.8, 0.9 degrees higher global average than before the Industrial Revolution. But in fact, we in the regions which count most, which is in the poles where the ice is melting, it's reached 4 and 5 degrees temperature rise. It's melting the ice and melting the permafrost.
When Radio EcoShock continues, we'll move into our climate future with Dr. Andrew Glickson and find out how climate scientists cope with the awful truth.